Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to another episode of Everyone is Hot, the podcast that talks about your favorite stealth sex symbols and the film or TV show that turned you on to them. I'm Michael Stevens.
And I'm Shelley Brooks. And oh my gosh, Michael, we've got a very fun guest today, do we not?
Do we? Who do we have?
We have a food scholar, a protector of women's healthcare, and a friend of Shelley, who she has known since college and who lived with her previously. We've got Olivia Dunbar. Oh.
You are a big hit with the youth.
The youth, I know.
The kids love you. Oh my God.
Wild. Yeah. Shelley, I feel like the last of those, friend of Shelley, is probably the most accurate qualifier. But thank you so much, Shelley.
That is not true. This lady has a master's in food. Come on.
That's amazing.
Yes, and she works with women's healthcare. Come on, don't sell yourself short, girl. What the hell?
Yeah, we need you.
Seriously, like, oh my God, in this day and age, we need you very much. Olivia, thank you so much for coming on. We're so excited to have you.
Yeah, thank you both for inviting me. I'm excited to talk about my favorite self sex symbol.
So to that point,
So who is your stealth sex symbol and what movie are we going to be talking about?
So my stealth sex symbol is Koji Yakusho in 13 Assassins, which is the Takashi Miike remake of a 60s samurai film from 2011.
Yes. And so we are very excited to have you on because I can't speak for Michael, but I will say that one of my big blind spots is that, like, I don't know that much about Japanese cinema and you know so much about it. And so I'm very excited for you to, like, enlighten us.
Ditto. You can't speak for me. I don't know anything.
I appreciate that because, like, I can say that I do know more about, like, good Japanese cinema, but I have seen some of the not so good live action anime adaptations. So,
oh, very cool.
The spectrum of experience is wide.
Yeah, again, Olivia is underplaying her knowledge because, I mean, she is someone who knows so much about cinema generally, but also, like, every time you talk about Japanese films, I'm like, oh my God, there's so much that I have to learn. Like, it makes me very excited to, like, explore things that, like, I don't really know that much about. But speaking of, Michael, for anyone who has not seen 13 Assassins, could you tell the listeners what the movie is about?
Sure thing. Set in 1844, toward the end of the Edo period, a group of 13 assassins comprising 12 samurai and a hunter secretly plot to assassinate Lord Matsudaira Naritsugu, the murderous leader of the Akashi clan, to thwart his appointment to the powerful shogunate council.
So, Olivia, I have to ask you, why did you give us such a brutal movie so much?
Yeah, you know,
weekend morning.
That was my main question. I'm like, yo. Right. So you have been friends for a long time, and she's known about this show for a while, and this
and
was,
I was like,
this is the one. Violence. This is the one.
See, it's funny because like there was a lot of Shelly and I had a bit of back and forth because I was like, there are many Koji Yakusho performances where he is, I would say, not stealth in his sex symbol status. And it was really between 13 Assassins and Cure, which is another really fantastic, say, like, psychological horror film by Kiyoshi Kurosawa, if anyone hasn't seen it. But again, yeah, it's
equally
like,
brutal movie.
Yeah, exactly. It was perfect. Like,
so
which
brutal performances.
Yeah, it was like, which one do I want to watch? You know, what is 13 Assassins, which is like a really great and very well done, like, samurai action film, despite being like, again, as you both said, extremely brutal, or like Cure, which is like psychologically like very
just like
very
existentially
brutal.
Devastating just
intense. And I haven't seen his more like, he was in the original Shall We Dance, which probably would have been like a lighter hearted
a bit
entree into his filmography, but again, I haven't seen that one because I'm not really into ballroom dancing. Yeah, so that is how I ended up in 13 Assassins. It's just like great film, many hot men, many psycho hot men. I love it. It's such a good movie.
Well, we famously love psychos on this show.
Yeah, we do.
But before we get further into the conversation, we do like to get a little warmed up.
Absolutely. You might pull something if you don't.
Exactly. You gotta get loose. You gotta get slick. You gotta get ready for the sexy trivia game. Now, Michael, for those who don't know, what is the sexy trivia game?
Well, it's a little bit of a warm-up to get y'all slick for some movie chatting using a little bit of movie trivia. I will kick us off. The opening sequence of this film is a shot-by-shot recreation of the 1960s era original.
Oh, that's pretty hot.
He probably saved a lot of time on storyboarding.
We love a little parallel play.
Yeah.
Olivia, could you read us number B?
Of course. Matsudaira Naritsugu was a real historical figure. He lived from 1811 to 1835. He was lord of the area called Akashi, which is nowadays in the Kansai area of Japan.
That's so sexy.
So sexy. What? We gotta talk about this character a little bit later in the episode. He did some evil things. Were they all real?
Deeply upsetting. But I'm gonna finish us off with letter C. The 13 assassins plan to attack Matsudaira Naritsugu. I'm probably pronouncing that very badly. While he's journeying to Edo, the old name for Tokyo. In the Edo period, the lords of Japan had to travel and stay in Edo. This was called Sankin Kutai, or official journey. The lords stayed to show their loyalty to the shogun, and the system helped the shogun keep tabs on the lords. And that is a badly pronounced, but very sexy trivia game.
I think we all did our best.
We all really
Give
tried.
Game.
Again, again, a reminder to the listeners, we have one person on this podcast who knows Japanese, and it's not me or Michael. Now, Olivia, do you remember when you first saw this movie?
I kind of do. You know, I think I had been going through a phase of, like, watching a lot of, actually some of Takashi Miike's films, but not, I still haven't seen, like, I think his, like, Ichi the Killer or any of his, or Audition or any of his, like, I love how we're like, this is a brutal film, but those are,
I really enjoyed this movie, but like I still have not watched Audition because like I don't think that I have the stomach for it.
I don't think I can.
Ooh, what's
either.
Audition all about?
It's like famous for being like one of the like a very violent, like kind of brutal film, and like I mean, in this I think is kind of like lower tier brutality in terms of like the Takashi Miike filmography. But yeah, I mean, I've read the Wikipedia synopsis of Audition.
Oh, I'm reading
times,
it now.
Yeah,
and I don't think I can watch it.
Yeah. I mean, there's not to interrupt, Michael. There's like famously a scene where you know the female main character is this like serial killer. I guess is the best way to describe her. Is she like keeps one of her victims like she basically like mutilates them and like slowly like decapitates them and is keeping one of her victims like in a bag, and the bag, you don't know that someone like a person is in the bag, and then all of a sudden it like starts moving, and it's like obviously the tension of the scene is a lot higher than me just describing it.
Family fun for
just a light-hearted
like light entertainment.
It's a Wonderful Life kind of vibe, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he seems to really love some dismemberment, Takashi Miike. Yes,
that's his like bread and butter, which is so funny because again, he does all of these like anime live actions, like that like Magic Girl group live action, and JoJo's Bizarre Adventures, he did the live action film for that. But yeah, he loves the like very gory. I think it's unsurprising that like Quentin Tarantino loves him. Like
loves him. Yeah.
Checks out. Yeah.
Yeah. He's that type of like very intense genre director that everyone loves.
Yeah, I mean, so did you first kind of like become interested in Koji Yakusho like through this movie, or were you familiar with his work before you saw this?
I don't think I necessarily really I obviously took note of him in this film and like him and his performance in this film in general, but like the more I got into contemporary Japanese cinema and television, the more I was like, oh, this guy is like clearly like a very, very well-known and well-respected actor and very talented in a landscape where there are some not so great actors and not so great films. And then there was a lot of like recognition that I'd seen, you know, Tom Popo, and didn't really realize that he was the Man in the White Suit and all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, now I feel like I'm a little bit more committed to seeing things that he's in because I know that he's so hot.
Well, it's funny. So I mean, we talked about the fact that, you know, there were a few different movies that he was in that we discussed, you know, featuring on this episode, and like, you know, I you know, put the kibosh on Tom Popo because he's like so clearly supposed to be like the hot guy in the movie.
Yes. Of course.
So was that like, what is your sort of like relationship like with his work going from something like Tom Popo, where he is like, you know, a sort of matinee idol type, to something like 13 Assassins, where he, I mean, he's still obviously like a very handsome man, but it's like a very different kind of performance because he's older and he's more sort of like weathered in this, like in a way that I find very fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting for him in particular because he just has so much gravitas in his presence and performance that I don't know really if, you know, I feel like the it's almost like somewhat of a lazy comparison to always compare like international actors with like American movie stars. But I don't know if he really has a, any type of like
an analog.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Like,
I mean, I did think watching it that maybe like a corollary would be like a Brad Pitt or someone that like was just so impossibly beautiful when they were young, and that like, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but like I did love his performance in that because like it felt like he really came into something really interesting by just by virtue of looking older, you know?
Yeah. Mm.
That's an interest. Yeah, that does make a lot of sense because I do think that, especially in this film, you know, he, the weatheredness of him being, you know, this elder statesman samurai is what I found so hot, but like it also leads, it like lends so well to his performance because there's a lot of like, there are a lot of beats in the film that like with a different actor would not have been nearly as good or as resonant, you know. I think the scene kind of at the beginning of the blowout fight and the village where he's like standing on the barricade and just like unfurls the scroll that what was it, like total massacre or total destruction or something like that, and I got like chills. It was so good.
I mean, he feels like a man who's like seen life. And like that's always like a very exciting thing to like see in an actor. Cause I mean, like, you know, obviously, like, you know, part of the reason why we go to the movies is to see like beautiful people blown up, like, you know, many feet tall. But I do think that like there's something to seeing like an older or like a middle-aged actor and like just seeing that they've got the gravitas of having lived for a while that is more, so much more sexy than like seeing just someone who is like a beautiful young thing, you know.
God, I'm not gonna dig into this point too much, but I just finished watching Clash by Night and read that Barbara Stanwyck was like 45 when she was doing that movie, and I was like, there's a haunted grace that she has about her. And then immediately after watching that, I watched 13 Assassins. And I was like, I'm familiar with a lot of Koji Yakusho's work, but there was me trying to figure out like what is it that's doing it for in this role. And he definitely has that same kind of, I mean, in a very different context obviously, but a certain kind of haunted grace about him that you see in a lot of westerns and samurai movies and war movies. I mean, I think it's kind of what we're talking about with Brad Pitt. We've also seen it with Hugh Jackman, who's another actor I feel like is, you know, in this realm. But yeah, I definitely feel you on this guy. He's got a haunted grace about him.
And there just seemed to be a great like legacy of that in like samurai movies especially. I mean, like I think about you know, a lot of like those 60s like samurai movies, like that oftentimes it's like a middle-aged guy who's like just kind of worn down in a way that's like very appealing.
And I do find that like with the time period of the film, which in a certain way I think it's not the people don't really I guess like focus in on, you know, it being kind of the sunset of the Edo period, which obviously they wouldn't have known, but that so many of them talk about, you know, where the time of the samurai is like largely over, like we've been living in a time of peace, this isn't we're not used to really fighting, and that's obviously like a lot of the tension with this Naritsugu is this like horrible figure who just seems to really relish destruction and fighting and bloodshed, and is like so energized by that in an obviously very dark and disgusting way. But it's so interesting that this film is like, none of, there are obviously like younger men in the group of assassins, but it's, there's this generational divide between like the Kojiakushos and like the teachers and their students who join them on this mission, where the teachers are basically like, we've never really had to fight outside of the dojo setting, like where this is Bushido, like this is Bushido, this is like our code, we're going to live by this code, and it's exciting for them to be doing that and being able to like sacrifice themselves to a higher mission. But it's just so interesting because like you wonder to what extent the younger men are conditioned by living in peace for so long that the threat of war that this really just disgusting Lord brings is not clear to them, I think, in a certain way.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting that, like, I mean, this is a film from 2011, but I mean, it feels very, very relevant right now. I mean, like, you know, I think that we're all kind of, like, cognizant of, like, this feeling of, like, being in the end of empire or whatever. Yeah, that it feels like we're sort of, like, in the twilight of our, you know, our national culture. And it does feel like we are sort of like on, you know, a precipice like that, and I feel like he really embodies in like a very beautiful and tragic way like the feeling that a lot of people have right now, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
The whole time that point is brilliant and resonates a lot, because the whole time I've been taking my feelings about like every rich person that I interact with and imposing them on Lord Naritsugu, and I didn't like a lot of the feelings that I had of God, kill this man. This man. Make him bleed for what he's done. Oh, God. God. Yeah, satisfying experience. I also don't know who I am anymore.
The movie, like, it really inspires some, like, really complicated feelings of, like, you know, on the one hand feeling like there's a certain righteousness, but on the other hand feeling like, you know, it's just like you don't want to acknowledge any sort of like violent feelings in yourself, but
I also think it's really interesting because basically the assassins are sent on this mission almost as like a, they're not really, they are working for the shogun, but they're not allowed to acknowledge that because Naritsugu is his half-brother. And in a way, it's the tension between, like, we're doing this in order to protect the shogun, but also the reason why this lord is able to do what he does is because he's the shogun's brother.
Right.
And he's terrible. Yeah. He's really the worst. But again, like within the context of, oh, the Meiji Restoration starts like a few decades later. They're essentially just working so hard to prop up a system that ends up collapsing within a very short period of time, which is interesting.
Well, so it's interesting, like, Olivia, you obviously like know a great deal about Japanese history. I mean, how do you find that something like this movie is like reflexive of, you know, what was happening in the country at the time in like 2011, like telling these kind of stories about history and through the lens of the contemporary period when it was being made? Like, do you find that there are some parallels there?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I'm not super familiar with, one second.
Yeah, because I also just, I mean, I as someone who like doesn't really know that much about Japanese history, I mean, it's been very interesting seeing like some of the political stuff that's like, you know, become very visible to us outside of Japan, like the, you know, the like assassination, like it's very fascinating, but it, like it's so sort of like outside of my realm of knowledge.
Right, you mean the Abe assassination?
Yeah,
or, yeah. Ugh. That's just a wild interlude of like,
yeah,
random like, guy kills a former political figure, and then the coverage of it and the consensus afterwards is like, maybe this guy had like a legitimate grievance, which is wild.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Not so necessarily.
I just have
no
context for that.
I mean, I just wanted to double check that I wasn't like misrepresenting the timeline, but in 2011, that's when the Fukushima.
Oh, right.
Disaster happened. And like, I obviously this coming out in the same year, it's not like going to be reflective of that time period.
Right.
But I think there's this constant, especially in Japanese media, like there were so many films and like the Japanese New Wave and that whole era of filmmaking where art house films in Japan were much more responsive to contemporary political events than I think many mainstream films are now. You know, you have Hideaki Anno, who's famous for being the creator of Neon Genesis Evangelion, who like does all of these reboots of like, he did Shin Godzilla, which was like basically this very like bureaucratic take on that monster story, and has been doing all those types of reevaluations of, again, very large Japanese properties, but still with like much more of a historical, cultural, contextual analysis angle that maybe isn't there. I do wonder if, you know, Takashi Miike like made this film because he was trying to say something. I mean, again, someone who's directed over 100 films, like how many of those are really societal statements versus just like loving film and generating, being a great, I mean, he's a great filmmaker, being a strong filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, like, you know, as, you know, someone who also makes art, like, I mean, I think that oftentimes, like, you know, you don't intentionally mean to reflect, like, what's going on, but but you can't help but be influenced by sort of the cultural overwhelming feelings that are, like, happening, you know, in society, so... Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, whether it's like maybe intentionally reflecting like what's happening around him, or if it's just that he's writing a story and he can't help but be, you know, impacted by the world that he lives in, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's this whole like cusp period of like late Edo period, early Meiji period. There's this continued, I think, both in Japan and just general cultural fascination with obviously samurai in general, but that transition from, you know, the shogunate and samurai and the samurai code really being very powerful to when the Meiji Restoration happened and that entire population was essentially like uprooted from their responsibilities and their way of living was decimated, and for better and for worse, obviously, but that's a complete change in systems of power. And I think there is this still constant tension in Japanese cinema with the concept of like tradition and cultural specificity and change, and how do we continue to honor our traditions but also like not dwell too much in the past. I mean, that's every culture, but I think particularly in Japan that tends to be much more pronounced.
Well, to move a bit away from you know, sort of granular history and politics, so something that I found really interesting in the movie is that, I mean, obviously, like, he is like a objectively a good looking man. But I was thinking a lot about how, you know, it, you know, famously, like, people on Twitter, like, are, you know, gaga over, like, Toshirô Mifune, and, like, but, you know, when you watch these, like, old samurai movies, it's, like, they're styled in a way, like, with, like, the hair and, like, the, you know, the being bald on the top, like, that is not exactly like what we would find like attractive today. So I mean, like, what do you think it is about, like, in these like samurai movies that like still is like so appealing for people, even though it, like, it would seem to be like the way that like the men are styled seems to be like so outside of like what we are, you know, attracted to in like, you know, contemporary New York.
Right, that's an interesting point. I mean, when you think about like the group of assassins, it's what only two of them don't have the shaved head, and it's the nephew character who basically is like turned his back on being a samurai, and the hunter slash kind of supernatural figure that they come across in the forest who's just like wild and completely like outside of that entire
so much
so good. He's wild.
I think it's just like this it's a very clear and very specific type of like masculinity that's so attractive, and so I don't necessarily think it's that it's dated per se, but it's very value driven and very honor driven in a way that feels kind of timeless almost. Like, sure, it comes from, there are still aspects of, you know, misogyny and honor specifically in this film related to like your family and women being raped or killed or dismembered horrifyingly, but yeah, I think the attractiveness there is that there's like still this, you have these men who are very much driven to fight for their beliefs and for, to fight for other people in a way that you don't necessarily come across all the time in regular day-to-day life.
Yeah. And it also helps to have like a really good face, which which he definitely has. Well, so, do you remember the like first movie crush that you had?
Ooh, first movie crush. I mean, I can think of like my first like media anime crush more readily.
Absolutely.
Which is Sesshomaru from Inuyasha. I was like, I love like an aloof, white haired, pretty boy.
Love it.
Within the anime community, which is like very embarrassing. I hate being like, I am a type. That's that's always the worst feeling. I'm not special. Oh my god. But my first movie crush, that's like always really hard because
TV.
It doesn't have to be the exact first.
Yeah.
I definitely went through like a very intense Cillian Murphy phase when I was in like middle elementary school. Very timely, obviously, with his Oppenheimer performance and everyone having discovered that he has beautiful haunting eyes and Peaky Blinders.
And as the people on Twitter say, a slutty little waist.
Oh, yeah, I love it. I saw a clip recently of him like laughing at something and someone commented, this is the first time I've ever seen Cillian Murphy laugh ever. And I was like, that seems about right.
Yeah, what was the one that like really got you into Cillian Murphy? Because I remember when he, what was the, Pluto something, the one
Breakfast
where he
Breakfast on Pluto, where that it was like that was great.
That did a lot for me as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, what was it like 13 days later, the like Danny Boyle, like
28 days later.
28 days later, sorry. Wow, 28 days later for sure. And then I was like, I have to see everything. So I saw Red Eye when it was in movie theaters, which was wild.
Listen, all the Zoomers, they think that like they've just discovered Cillian Murphy, and like, listen, we were into him back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Sunshine came out when we were in high school. Like,
yes,
I love him in Sunshine. It's the only movie I love him in that movie, and it's the only movie that I like that Chris Evans in.
Oh
wow!
Okay. Yeah.
Oh. It's the only movie I actually find him attractive in. Also, so. Mm.
I Sunshine love a movie where people go to space and go insane. Best.
Oh my
What's
god!
What's the one with Sam Neill?
Oh, yeah, I was gonna say Claire Denis.
And the Claire Denis one. Yeah,
Julia Roche in the like box where she just like masturbates for.
Yeah, the fuck box. Yeah,
the fuck box. Yeah,
what movie is this?
Oh, is it like High Life or something?
High Life.
Yeah, yeah, and I. They showed it at BAM when I worked there, and she and Robert Pattinson came together and they were so cute together. I fell in love with him that day because I was like, he's fine. But then I saw him in person and I was like, oh, this man is the most beautiful person I've ever seen.
God. Oh.
And okay. He was so sweet with her. Oh, I loved it.
Damn, I gotta revisit Claire Denis' work.
Listen.
Talk about beau travail. Talk about sexy homoerotic tension. Come on.
Seriously. Oh,
no, I say that, but I think it's Friday Night is like one of my favorite sex scenes of all time.
Literally have the Friday Night poster on my wall. I love this movie so much.
I need the Twitter version of like what is so great about this this sex scene specifically.
So I'm one of those people who I feel very strongly both in terms of like sex and violence that like the less you show, the more engagement it is, because like you as an audience member filling in kind of the gaps in what you aren't shown is it brings you into the actual moment. So this is like the most kind of so not explicit at all. It's just like close-up shots of like someone's neck and their pulse beating under their skin, and it's great.
Denis is so good at that. Oh my god. Like the scene in Beau Travail, with like the his vein like pulsing and you're like,
oh my god,
this man has definitely masturbated.
Okay, I need to watch like
touching
this
a gun
shit.
Yeah,
I need to watch
a symbol
this
for his penis.
I'm not into the like bluest warmest color scissoring or like any of that. I need like
let you use someone, your mind.
Yes, yeah.
Like, someone touch me here, like, you know?
Yeah,
don't throw a bunch of fucking crap at me, Christopher Nolan. We all know you've never had sex before.
Oh my God. I don't know, Michael, if you've seen this, but someone posted like a screenshot of the screenplay from Oppenheimer where it's like the exact sex scene. And in the screenplay, I love when like whatever someone describes action, it's like all in capital letters. And from the scene in Oppenheimer, Nolan said like fucking, like just capital letters. Like,
unfortunately,
I was like, yeah, that sounds about right.
I love explicit sex scenes, like, so I can't get on board with this. But like, but
you're
listen,
like, if I don't see Bush in a wiener, like, this is not
I want to see you eat ass.
Something about a close-up shot of like someone's neck, though. Yeah.
I mean, listen, when it
feels
good,
explicit. Like,
yeah,
there's a way to do it where it feels like I wasn't supposed to see that, but
don't get me wrong, like I love like watching like a period piece where like you see someone's ankle and you're like, oh my God, this is pornography.
I love that shit. That's my shit.
It's great.
Oh god, my gosh.
So Michael, do you have any movies that you would put in a double feature with 13 Assassins? And Olivia, same question to you.
Honestly, I wanted to have something like a war movie or a Western or a samurai movie, but today, this is how I started my morning. I actually think the movie pairing that I'm going to go with is A Wonderful Life by Frank Capra. I just need to look.
Yeah,
these movies don't connect
here.
These movies don't connect. They have nothing to do with each other. They're not similar. Normally a movie pairing, you would want one of those things.
Yeah.
But sometimes I treat movie pairings like chasers, you know? So sometimes you have your shot, and then you chase it down with some Coca-Cola, and I need some Coca-Cola. I really enjoyed this viewing, but before I interact with the physical world today, I gotta watch something dumb or optimistic.
I will say, like, It's a Wonderful Life is like also a pretty bleak movie. So.
Yeah, it is.
Oh my God. But I love that. That is a great pairing. Oh my God. Olivia, what do you think? What would you be your pairing?
I would probably say if you're like into a good samurai film, obviously can't go wrong with Kurosawa, but I would say Hidden Fortress if you're looking for like hot Mifune, like on not necessarily, he's like very dirty in this, so that I feel like that ties into the like rugged samurai-ness of 13 Assassins.
Ooh, I'm adding this to my Letterboxd.
That's so good.
Yeah, I also so I thought that my pairing would be Kurosawa's Ran, because I think that they're similarly like bleak worldviews in both movies. There's something like very like Shakespearean about 13 Assassins, and you know what better than Kurosawa's take on Shakespeare? So yeah, that would have to be mine.
So we have three perfect pairings.
We're like all brilliant is the thing.
Yes.
I know.
They're
it's
all
crazy.
Accurate.
All we're like all really smart
in relevance.
Well, now I think we can go to our game. So we like to on occasion play Fuck, Marry, Kill on this show. Olivia, we are going to do a Koji Yakusho Fuck, Marry, Kill. So we're gonna have 13 assassins, your other pick that was Tampopo, and then you recommended Blood of the Wolves, which Michael and I have not seen. So
right.
For any listeners who have not seen these movies, could you talk us through what each movie is about, like what his characters are in those movies.
So obviously 13 Assassins, Tom Popo, he plays the man in the white suit. So just sexual figure, matinee idol, sexual figure. There's a very famous scene in Tom Popo where he passes an egg yolk orally from him between himself and another woman. And it's very, very, again,
he's playing
alluding
around
to sex, but not actually being sex is
he
very
plays too much.
And yeah, Brahman is sex in that movie.
Right. And then Blood of the Wolves is this really, really great, like, 80s, I mean, more recent, but it's a 80s Yakuza, 80s set Yakuza film where he plays, like, this dirty cop who's essentially playing both sides. And
ugh, what a piece of shit.
It's so great. It's really great. He's really great in that.
Oh, my God. Perfect. All right. So, Olivia, you start us off. Fuck, marry, kill.
Unfortunately, this is tough because, like, originally it would have been easier because we were thinking of Memoirs of a Geisha, but I, like, yes, it could not reasonably recommend going to see that at all. I'm going to have to say, marry 13 Assassins, fuck Blood of the Wolves because this guy fucks in this movie. And then I guess Tom Popo I'm going to kill just because he's, like, too pretty.
Fair enough.
Oh, my God.
Michael, what are your thoughts?
Okay. I've been taking my notes as my notes are useless. So let's see. I'm going to fuck Tom Popo, Koji. He sounds like my type. That makes perfect sense. Let's see. Blood of the Wolf. I'm going to kill him because fuck the police. And 13 Assassins.
Cop. He's a corrupt cop.
He's a corrupt cop? Oh,
worse.
Even better.
Worse.
Even better. Tie him up. And then, and then I'm going to marry him in 13 Assassins. That's the easiest. This is the easiest fuck, marry, kill I've ever had to do. I need to actually watch these other two movies, but he seems
you'll
like
love it, Michael.
He's demonstrated he's a great husband.
Yeah, Michael, you stepped on my fuck, marry, kill a little bit because I also would kill Blood of the Wolf because cop.
Kill together.
I would fuck him in 13 Assassins because he is very, very hot, but I don't think that we could sustain a life together, and I would have to marry him in Tom Popo because he's just a beautiful, beautiful boy in that movie.
Yeah.
And I love him. Olivia, this was so, so fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people follow you on social media? And do you have anything coming up that people should look out for?
So you all can follow me on Letterboxd. I'm at OBD2102.
That's hell yeah.
Basically the only, like, public social media profile I have.
That's the only one that people need.
Yes.
Right. But I'm just like, I need to follow some, like, IRL people on Letterboxd. So it's not just me following, like, every critic that
I'm about to follow before. You.
Oh, I am. Michael, yes. Real life connection.
Yes. I am. I am definitely not a critic. I am only a person.
Michael, stop.
I can't. No, it's what I pride myself on.
Everyone
you are a
can
public
be a
figure,
critic.
My God.
Yeah. I do have to admit to, like, the only kind of passive aggressive move that I do on Letterboxd is if I feel like I need to withhold my judgment. I don't give anything a star.
I have not
given Theater Camp any. A
rating. Whoa, we don't like Theater Camp. Oh gosh. Listen, I haven't seen it yet.
We will talk in our texts about
Theater what Camp. We think about
Theater Camp.
Ooh, I got some things to say about some people in that movie, but
as do we.
Yep. My lips are sealed.
But that's not what we're here to talk about. We are here to talk about our great crushes. And Michael, where can people find us on social media?
You can find us on all social medias at Everyone Is Hot Pod. That's Everyone Is Hot. Everyone Is Hot Pod, number one. And if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere where you can rate us, please rate us 5 stars. Anything less will get your head chopped off.
Yes, we will absolutely kill you if you
we'll
don't
kick it around.
And also, what is the most important thing for listeners to do?
Stay horny.
Horny.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.